It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the State Department of Natural Resources has some new PFAS chemical regulations in the works for Wisconsin water. We'll talk to a water law and policy expert about the kind of impact those regulations could have. First, the pandemic led a lot of people to think about the way they spend their time. Why? Maybe it's because our routines were disrupted for a while there. Partly it might be that the large toll of the pandemic might have caused people to rethink priorities and values. That could mean spending less time working, less time worrying, maybe more time having fun. It might mean just learning to accept that time is finite. We won't be able to do all the stuff we want to do. We're talking about how the pandemic caused many people to reprioritize the things that matter most of that to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Did the pandemic make you think about the way you spend your time? Do you realize you were spending a lot of time doing stuff that really didn't mean much to you? If so, how did you break those habits? How did you refocus? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rachel Feinzig is the work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, writing about the intersection of jobs and everything else. Rachel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you wrote about this, the reprioritization that a lot of people were doing. What led you down that path?
I just want to, you know, make my own personal existential crisis everyone else's existential crisis. That's at least the feedback I got from a lot of people. No, honestly, the lead of the story is really what prompted me to write about this. I was taking a run a couple of months ago and ran past the elementary school that my oldest child is going to attend in a couple of months. And I saw all these parents streaming out, moms and dads, you know, holding their kids' hands. And I just thought to myself, like, am I doing this right? Like, what should I be doing with every hour? You know, especially now that I work from home and I have a lot of work to do, but I have freedom and flexibility too. And like, am I prioritizing the right things? And that's what motivated me to finally write about this.
And you went out talking to people, and it turns out you are not the only person on the face of the planet who was having those kind of thoughts. What kind of stuff did you hear from people?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the thing, right? Like, I don't want to be writing about things that only impact me. I wanted to get a sense of if other people from all walks of life, you know, not just, you know, I'm a younger parent of young kids. You know, I wanted to see if other people were feeling this. And what I found was they were. Like, a lot of people were thinking about time, how they spend their hours, just kind of feeling it differently in this moment. And it was super interesting to me and comforting, honestly, right? To be able to commiserate with other people and know it's not just you.
What were some of the things you heard from people about the ways maybe they found themselves spending time that when they looked at it, they thought, why? Why am I so spending so much time on fill in the blank?
Social media, for sure, was one of the ones that came up, just kind of scrolling your phone. Fantasy football, like this idea that there are things that we like, and it's okay if we like them. You know, I talked to one person, and this didn't even make it in the story, but, you know, he likes sports, and it's totally reasonable to spend X number of hours watching his favorite football team. But when it got to the point where it was taking over his life, and every weekend was just him and his TV watching a million games instead of, you know, spending time with his partner, that's when it started to click that, like, huh, am I kind of doing this right? So a lot of that, like, people realizing, feeling like, I don't have time to meditate or, like, do whatever thing that they wanted to or should be doing, but then being like, huh, my phone says I've spent like 3 hours on Instagram this week. Maybe there is some time there.
Talking to Rachel Feinzig from the Wall Street Journal. Rachel wrote a piece recently on people reevaluating how we spend our time making changes or trying to make changes. You could join in if you have rethought what you spend a lot of time on, if you focused it elsewhere, meaning maybe something more meaningful or maybe something intentionally less meaningful. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media for some people to share their stories. Here's a listen to Muna Algathy, early learning education engagement specialist at PBS Wisconsin.
For me, the pandemic really made me reassess my time in that it made me realize how much I prioritized work over my own well-being and over my family. And so in that, I've really been able to reprioritize and recognize that at the end of the day, family and my well-being has to come first. And that was really hard because I absolutely love my job and I love what I do. And at the same time, I was committing way more than I had to my job. And I didn't even notice the way that it was taking from me and taking from my family and taking from my presence. And honestly, the pandemic really just enabled me to be more plugged in than normal, because my home became my office. And so I've had to really challenge myself to be more present and to reprioritize my family and my own health.
Rachel, work-life balance is kind of a buzz word or buzz phrase, I guess. But was that a common story you heard from people, like how much of my time and commitment is going to work versus the other stuff?
Totally. And like the mental and emotional load, like if I'm still thinking about it and obsessing about it and ruminating about it, even when I'm not on my computer or I'm running over to check, you know, because it's like in my bedroom and just work is all around all the time. Like, what, like, yeah, what's the point? And I think also the sense, which we heard in that example, like a lot of people like their jobs. I mean, we've written the story about people quitting and or moving, you know, somewhere new. And that's a totally valid experience too. But I was kind of curious, like, what if you kind of like most of the stuff in your life, but you still feel like maybe you just haven't got the balance quite right? Like the puzzle pieces aren't quite where they should be, but you don't need to quit your job and you don't need to move to the countryside. What does it look like to just kind of tweak here and there and just make like slightly different choices?
You talk to people, some experts and some real people about the strategies we can use to make those tweaks. One was just as simple as like limiting how much a phone is going to ring into our lives and bother us with updates and notifications.
That was a great example, right? It was a person that I was talking to. He works in the New York area, kind of for like a financial services research kind of firm. And he had set his phone to only ring when someone in his address book was calling him. It was this idea. He told me, like, those people aren't entitled to my time. Like those telemarketers, like whoever is calling me, they don't need to burst in when I'm having a real conversation with my son. And so it was kind of this protective measure that is obviously tiny, but I thought was great advice.
And you talked to some experts on time management, on how to manage our time, or in some cases, how to give up managing our time. What kind of things did you hear?
Totally. A lot of it was like really existential, right? Like, I mean, I've written about time management a bunch over the last couple of years. I've talked to a lot of those experts. I think they have good things to say. But for this story, I was kind of wanted the more existential point of view. And so, you know, Oliver Berkman, who wrote this book that has resonated with a lot of people called 4,000 Weeks, which is the title is based on kind of the typical number of weeks that people have in a lifetime. And I mean, his like old take is just like, let it go. Like the more obsessing you do, like, it's just counterproductive. You will never feel like you have cleared the decks. You will not, you know, we all say like next week will be less busy. Like the truth is it never will be. And you need to learn to tolerate that discomfort of knowing that there's a million things battling for your attention and that you're going to feel underwater. And you need to kind of let that go and pick the important things so that you don't have to feel like I can get to the important email once I've cleared out these 50 silly emails. So you let those 50 silly emails just sit there and you go for that important one and you give it like an hour of your like true focus. That's kind of his idea.
I want to bring on another story from a colleague here, Jason Butler, assistant to the director at WPR.
I don't mind wasting my time as much anymore. Like I've really come to realize that, you know, it's perfectly okay to waste my time. I really appreciated that idea that like staying home and just not having to go out was a heroic act. And like, and I, you know, it was perfectly fine to like, just do that. And I'm actually kind of resenting now this pressure to go out and do things. Not that I don't enjoy it, but like, I just feel like it's perfectly okay to kind of waste my own time. And I get to choose to do that if I want.
Yeah, Rachel, a lot of time management relates to maximizing our use of time. Jason there saying, hey, sometimes it's okay to minimize it and intentionally enjoy not doing stuff.
I think it's a really good point. And that's part of what Oliver is saying, right? Like, we spend all this time trying to maximize everything. We read all these gurus telling us, you know, to prioritize this, organize it this way. And like, sometimes it's just better to let it go. And I feel like if you're wasting time consciously, like if that's what you want to do and you enjoy it and you don't sit up, you know, from like an Instagram hangover 2 hours later and like feel regret, if you really enjoy it, like, yeah, like that's the point, right? Just like go for it.
We're talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, looking at how people change the way they spend their time, reprioritize time during the pandemic. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you change the way you use your time? Were there things that used to seem really important that you moved in a new direction? Less time focusing on work, more on family. Less time on maximizing efficiency, more on fill in the blank for us. Let us know. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Wall Street Journal work and life columnist Rachel Feinzig about the ways that the pandemic spurred at least some people to rethink the way they spend their time, to come up with new priorities. Are you one of those people? You can tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Over the last couple of years, did you become more conscious about how you were spending your time? Did you see ways in which you thought maybe you were wasting your time or could have been spending it better? Do you leave yourself more slack in your day to do fun stuff, family stuff, you name it? Or have you just been able to set aside the phone and social media to be more present, as some people have? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rachel, we heard from a caller who couldn't stay on the line who thought, you know, this might be a silver lining. A societal reset can be a good thing that we might not have otherwise had. Do you see people like not just kind of stumbling into things, but being really conscious about making something good out of this moment and thinking about how they spend their time?
Yeah, definitely. It's something I hear a lot from parents, a lot of dads who maybe were home more than they were before, didn't have that long commute. And now, as we're kind of gearing back up again, going back to normal life, or, you know, in quotes, whatever that even means, you know, people want to keep that. They want to keep that slower pace. I don't know if everyone will succeed, but I think it's a noble goal. And I think people really are making changes with that in mind.
And slower pace, you just said, is that the trend, the norm you saw from a lot of people, what they were aspiring or working toward?
Yes and no. I mean, that was the case with some people. Other people told me they had, you know, decided to come up with bigger goals. Like, this made them feel, I talked to one person who had served as a nurse's aide in an ICU treating really sick COVID patients. He's a professor and a former Jesuit priest. And he said it had made him feel really grateful for his body, made him cherish little things, you know, like the ability to take a walk or feel the sunshine. But it also, like, kind of gotten him into gear to set these big goals. He's training for an Ironman triathlon. Like, I think for some people it's the opposite of slowing down, right? But it's like some sort of balance there between, like you can go too far, you know, down that road too, where you're like maximizing, or at least in my experience, like, this is something I was struggling with. Like, you feel like every 30 seconds has to be accounted for, and then like, and Oliver Berkman says that's not, you know, great either. So it's all a balance.
We heard from Paul Damberg, our Northern Regional Manager here at WPR. He says he started woodworking when he had to work from home. His wife, who's retired, felt he was encroaching on her space. So Paul made himself a shop, started woodworking, and he writes, "I started to do woodworking and repairing and manufacturing all hardwood wood products, first trivets and cutting boards, then friends' furniture and building furniture for myself and my son. It's become more than a hobby," he says, "now a passion." He's rethinking how to do some of the work after some medical issues, but he says he's smitten with woodworking, can't wait to start doing more serious projects. And that, it seems like, is something that I've heard from a lot of people. They've found a new passion, whether it's a hobby or some other activity like that. Is that something you heard from people, Rachel?
Yes. And I did another column that I kind of think of as related to this one a couple of weeks ago. And the headline was something like how to be more than just your job. And I think that's part of it, right? Like diversifying, having something else in your life besides just job and family. Obviously, both those things can be great. But when they're your entire identity, like I think for many people, it's not the best thing. And having something else that makes you feel like you, that gives you someone, an expert for that story told me, like, it's that I can't believe I just did that feeling. Like, I can't believe I made this cutting board with my own hands. Or for me, it was running. Like, I cannot believe I just ran 10 miles. Like, I was like, wow, the last pick for soccer, you know, in middle school, and I became a runner during the pandemic. So I think that feeling is so important. And you kind of can't go wrong if you're chasing that.
Talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Talk about how for the last couple of years, people have reprioritized how they spend their time. She heard from a lot of people, heard from some people around WPR. How about you? Had a hiccup with the phone lines. Looks like it's good now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you call right now, 800-642-1234. Did you find that new passion in your life? Did you commit yourself to spending more good quality time with friends or family members, your kids, maybe? Did you decide to put more time into work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rachel, apart from what we're doing with their time, and you've kind of touched on this a little bit, the idea of being present, of being engaged with whatever it is we're doing with our time. How big a part of the story is that?
Huge, huge. I mean, I talked to someone who had been working a ton earlier in the pandemic, kind of had an incident of severe burnout that made her reevaluate everything. I mean, she didn't have a choice. She like woke up one morning and couldn't get out of bed. She was so exhausted. And she ended up taking some time off from work. And she told me it was kind of in that quiet that she learned how to reprioritize her time, that she learned how to be present, how to really feel like herself. I think when we get so busy, it's like we go on autopilot, right? And so sometimes you do have to just slow down to be present. But I don't know. For me, it's made such a huge difference in terms of the time I spend with my kids. When my mind isn't somewhere else at the same time, I feel like I get like triple the bang for my buck, you know, like in terms of the time I'm spending with them. Like I get the funny moments and the smiles, and like, sure, sometimes they're screaming and, you know, then you don't really feel like being present for that. But in general, it's just like, that's really where you like build those memories. And so much of this is about memory, because that's like what we actually take with us from our hours.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Waukesha. Anne, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm a teacher, 28 years in Waukesha, and always teach my sixth graders, find what fills you up, do what makes you happy, you know, all of that. And then I finally realized I needed to do that after the pandemic and teaching through that. So I took a chance. Oh, I made a little pun here. I auditioned for a musical, and I haven't acted on stage since 1988. So it was kind of just to throw myself in there. We just wrapped Mamma Mia in the Waukesha Civic Theater this past weekend, and I was in the ensemble and just had a blast, met so many great people, and now the bug is in me again, and it's not going to go away.
Do you have another audition coming up, Anne? Are you going to take another chance, as Abba would say?
Yeah, right. It has to fit in a line with my teaching a little bit. So I have to kind of wait and see what falls into place, but I'm looking out there, and it's just a lot of fun.
Excellent. And thanks for sharing that. Break a leg. Rachel, she went back, rediscovered a lost or forgotten passion. And as she said, kind of filled herself up with doing something just like she recommends her students do.
That is so cool. That's just like the coolest thing. I love this idea of people just rediscovering these like surprise parts of themselves. I mean, so much of this is just about having fun, like living a little, having fun. Like life is so short. I mean, it's a little bit trite, but I think so many of us in our kind of modern work obsessed world have kind of strayed away from that. Like, you know, maybe a 16-year-old, or at least 16-year-old me, didn't need to be told to choose the fun thing, but, you know, 30-something me like does. And it sounds like Anne did that, like just choosing the joyful thing and taking a chance. It's incredible.
Thanks again for that call. Now, Rachel, you were already thinking about this before you set off to write this piece. Is there a piece of advice you got either from one of the sources you talked to or one of the experts you talked to that you are thinking, yeah, I got to integrate this into my life?
I think it's the idea of not clearing the decks. Like, I have that feeling all the time where it's like, I can get to the real stuff, you know, whether that's in my work or at home, like I can get to the important stuff once I take care of all this other stuff that's driving me crazy. And like, maybe you just let that other stuff be and like, you just leave it on your to-do list and you see what happens. And maybe no one will die if it takes you a week to get back to that unimportant email, you know, that's been something that's been really meaningful for me.
So if I finally made the decision that I'm never going to delete those thousands of emails on my personal and work accounts, it's going to work out okay?
Yeah, I did another column called like how to care less about your email. And it's shocking. People just declare email bankruptcy. They go on vacation. They just ignore everything. And they're like, the shocking part is like nothing happens. Like it's pretty much just fine. No one cares.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Feinzig is the work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, writing about the intersection of jobs and everything else. She talked to us about a piece she wrote about how the pandemic caused people to rethink what matters most to them and change the way they spend their time. Still time for you to share your story of how you spend your time and if it's changed over the last couple of years. You could let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you rekindled an old hobby, an old passion, or found a new one, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll learn more about new water standards in Wisconsin for synthetic chemicals known as PFAS and some new advisory guidelines coming from the EPA on that. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the researcher behind a new report on budgetary challenges facing Wisconsin townships. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is working on its first ever standards for regulating the harmful chemicals known as PFAS. The new rules will set limits for how much of the chemicals can be present in the state's drinking water and surface waters. That's going to require sampling and testing of water systems, remediation if the standards aren't met. Environmental groups see it as a positive for public health and the environment, while businesses and local governments have raised concerns about how much it would cost to meet these standards. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about these new standards? Do you want tighter regulation on these chemicals? The EPA now is out with advisory guidelines as well. Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a reporter at WPR's Superior Bureau. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
These standards have been in the works for a while. How did we get here?
Yeah, so back in 2019, Governor Tony Evers directed the agency, or the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, to develop standards to address PFAS contamination across the state. And then the Natural Resources Board signed off on developing those standards in January the following year. And then it's been about 3 years now since we started talking about this, since when they were finally approving standards through the Natural Resources Board, which are now set to take effect as soon as they go through the final steps in the process.
This gets complicated because we're talking about different kinds of water, whether it's surface or drinking water. There are actually different chemicals in this PFAS category. Big picture, Danny, when this thing kicks in, what changes?
Well, when this kicks in, this means that there will be a requirement for public water supplies to test for PFAS. And right now, it's about just really a fraction of the 11,000 public water supplies in Wisconsin have tested for PFAS. Some of them have urged the DNR to wait for federal standards for drinking water rather than proposing statewide limits on PFAS. And so now that this is happening, there will be a phase in, a gradual phase in of which communities or which systems will be required to test and how often and how that works.
Now, this had to be signed off on by a group of state lawmakers led by Republicans. They did say they'll do this. They could, as I understand it, maybe still suspend the standards if they don't feel they're being lawfully implemented. Can you just talk about the role that the state legislature is playing here?
Yeah, so basically once the Natural Resources Board moved these standards forward, it could go to the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules in the legislature. And that's basically led and controlled by Republican lawmakers. And so in the past, we've seen Republican lawmakers push back on attempts to regulate these chemicals. There were no objections raised this go around. So they're letting those take effect. And now it moves to the secretary for him to sign. That would be DNR Secretary Preston Cole. And then the rules will be submitted to Wisconsin's Administrative Register, and then they'll take effect about a month after publication.
And then when they take effect, does that mean day one cities have to get out there and start testing, or how does it phase in a way that we're going to see it have an effect?
No. What we've heard before from the Wisconsin DNR as of late May is that potentially, as soon as November, we could see the largest public water systems begin testing for PFAS. And some of them have already begun testing or done this sampling already, like Madison, Milwaukee, Eau Claire, Wausau. Those communities that have 50,000 or more people would be required to test. And then it would go in through phases for each other community based on their population size.
Danny, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, with us for a look at new state standards on PFAS chemicals in water. Now, just after these state standards got the go-ahead, the Environmental Protection Agency announced new advisory guidelines at the federal level for PFAS pollution. David Strifling is the director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you again.
Okay, with these EPA advisories, we're talking parts per trillion for some of these PFAS chemicals, much narrower than what the state is working on. Can you give us a sense of the difference in scale that we're talking about here?
Well, it's orders of magnitude. And what caused all this is that EPA's previous guideline had been 70 parts per trillion for a couple of the PFAS compounds that we're focused on here. And that's where the NRB landed in terms of approving the DNR's rules, because it felt that the state standards should match the federal standards. Well, now the EPA has sort of, I don't want to say pulled the rug out, but dramatically changed the game board by saying, well, instead of 70 parts per trillion for those compounds, we're going to lower it to 0.004 parts per trillion for PFOA and 0.02 for PFOS. So again, that's orders of magnitude lower than where it was before. And it's also significantly lower than the detection limit, which I understand to be about 4 parts per trillion. So we're talking about really undetectable levels of compounds here. And the question for DNR is, what do we do now that our standard, our brand new standard, is orders of magnitude higher than what the EPA is now telling us is safe?
What do we know about why the EPA narrowed that by orders of magnitude, as you said?
Well, they just say that they focused on the science. You know, we had a conversation here at Marquette last week, and we had Secretary Cole here with the EPA Region 5 Administrator, Deborah Shore. And I asked Regional Administrator Shore that question, you know, what's taking so long? Why the big change? And she said, we're just focused on the science. And this is what the science is telling us. It takes time for us to do this. We're sorry we're not moving faster, but we're going to take the time to do it right. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I don't pretend to understand all the explanation behind it, but that's what they're focused on.
And can you remind us why we're concerned about PFAS in our water? What are the health concerns that are leading these regulations?
Well, the first thing is that they're ubiquitous. It's very likely that if you and I were tested along with all of the listeners, these compounds would show up in our bloodstream. And pretty much that's true of every human being on the planet. And we know that they have significant health effects. They're carcinogens. They have significantly negative impacts on humans. And so they're in the environment, they're in our blood, and they cause lots of negative impacts on human health. And so I think everybody agrees on the need to do something about this. The disputes just come in at the margins, where we should set the limits, when they should kick in, who should be in charge, whether it's the state government or the federal government. That's what the dispute is about here.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Eric is with us in Lincoln County. Eric, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple points. The NRB setting that number at 70 parts per trillion, everybody knew that number was way, way high. Anybody with any kind of common sense knew that that number was going to come in much lower from the EPA. And currently we have an NRB member who's more than a year expired from his term, yet he's still sitting on the board making these decisions. And then the other quick point is the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce suing to keep the DNR from being able to enforce the Wisconsin Spills Act. These two activities are extremely heinous when it comes to protecting our water. And I'm hoping some of these issues get straightened out and we start to accept what the real level of safe PFAS consumption is.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call. Dave, let's start with his second point, because people may see headlines about the DNR enforcing some kind of PFAS regulations. And that's under, as Eric referenced, the Spills Act, not these new regulations. What is going on there?
Yeah, so there we're talking about contamination primarily in groundwater, not in drinking water, although, of course, groundwater can become drinking water. And the question is, can DNR enforce what's called, as you said, the spills law against a business who's conducting a cleanup? And the specific issue in that lawsuit was whether midstream, in the middle of the cleanup, DNR could add a requirement for the business owner to clean up PFAS compounds. And that's what that lawsuit was all about. The Waukesha County Circuit Court judge said that DNR couldn't do that without having a standard in place, without having a list of hazardous substances that it would force a business owner to clean up. The way that stands right now is that the judge has stayed the effect of that ruling so that DNR can appeal it. So we're going to have to watch that one as that proceeds its way up through the chain of courts. It'll be at the Court of Appeals next. But I agree with the caller that that has some major implications for DNR's authority to regulate PFAS. No question about it, along with other substances as well.
And Eric also mentioned, and we've got an email from Matt in Madison along the same lines, mentioning Fred Preen, who is on the Natural Resources Board. His successor was appointed, never confirmed by the Senate, the state Senate. So he's still there, I think, about a year into that now and helping to set these policies. Is that a concern people are raising at this point?
Well, it's certainly a concern on both sides of the aisle. I don't have any, legal opinion on who's right and who's wrong, but that is a major controversy, yes.
Thanks for the call, Eric. We're talking to Marquette Law School adjunct professor Dave Strifling about new PFAS standards planned for Wisconsin, plus an advisory guideline from the Environmental Protection Agency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have PFAS contamination in your community? How is it affecting you? Are you glad to see the state moving toward new regulations of these chemicals? Where do you think the level should be set? The EPA's very tight advisory guidelines are what we have in Wisconsin. Call in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Dave Strifling, director of the Marquette Law School's Water, Law, and Policy Initiative. He's with us today for a look at PFAS regulations on Wisconsin water. The DNR is working on new guidelines, and there's recommended guidelines out now from the EPA, much more stringent. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on these new standards at the state level, these new recommendations from the EPA? Is this an issue in your community? Are you drinking water out of bottles because you can't drink the water out of your tap? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So, I don't know, it was probably about 10 years ago, we had the whole issue with the BPAs and the baby formula bottles, and the manufacturers claimed, well, people demanded clear bottles, so the only way they could give us clear bottles was they had to put BPA in it. But that's obviously proven false because we have clear baby bottles still without BPA in it. Now we're being told that, oh, you've got to have PFAS or PFAS in the fire suppression foam in order to make it work better. Well, what is better? How much better? 1%? A tenth of a percent? Out of Truax, they probably dumped, in all the other airports that use this stuff, they probably dumped 1,000 times as much of this foam retardant to practice with it than they've ever used in practicality to fight an airplane fire. I can't even think of a report of an airplane fire out of Truax in the last 5 years, but it just seems like we're being duped into having to accept these chemicals, which now you've got Lakes Monona, Mendota, Wabisa, you can only eat one or two fish a month out of those things. And I wish the DNR, the state, would tighten up before these things get into our systems, before they get into the market.
Gotcha, Mike. I want to bring Dave Strifling in on this. Mike saying, can we stop using this stuff in the first place? He mentioned a common use of flame retardant, including at airports, but it's also lining nonstick pans, a lot of other uses. Are we working to get this stuff out of the product chain in the first place?
Yeah, it's a big issue. And we saw this with asbestos and a lot of other products along the way that in some cases, there just aren't any good substitutes, at least if the manufacturers are correct. And often what we see in environmental law is something called technology forcing. We want to force manufacturers to develop substitutes for these products by setting the limits lower and depend on our ingenuity, our technology, our R&D to come up with new solutions that aren't as toxic. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but that's the idea here.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us now in Green Bay. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I lived in Marinette for a number of years, over 20 years, and during that time, all this PFAS was being hidden by the legislature or legislator up there, and he worked with the companies accepted campaign contributions, so PFAS kind of ran rampant up there. And now people are being that were exposed, and my children went to school there. I have two children that have thyroid problems. One had a appendiceal cancer, and they all went through school in the Marinette area. And I'm wondering, you know, is there anything going to be happening in terms of class action or something against these companies that dumped all these PFAS into the water? The high school in Marinette was right next to where they were doing testing with PFAS for fire suppression foam.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Sorry to hear about all that affecting your kids. Dave, are people connecting the dots, PFAS, to those sort of health conditions? And Dennis wonders, maybe class action lawsuits on the way?
Yeah, really sorry to hear about your family, Dennis. So there's a couple of different issues here. One is the kind of toxic tort suits for injuries and cancers and deaths that are coming from this. And the other is environmental cleanup suits to force the companies to clean up polluted water. And I foresee both of those expanding going forward in the future as more and more becomes known about the science. Now, the causation is really the hard part when you talk about toxic tort suits. How do you prove that what happened came from PFAS? And so that'll be the issue as opposed to some other cause. But on both of those fronts, you know, and at our event last week, DNR Secretary Cole and EPA Regional Administrator Shore both said, we will go after those companies if we can tell who caused the problem. We're going to make them clean it up. And I think the same will be true on the toxic torch side. You're going to see more of that as the future comes.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Dave Strifling, director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, about regulations on these PFAS chemicals. PFAS, everybody else is saying. I never know which one to settle on. We heard, by the way, early on the morning show today from Deborah Shore with the EPA talking about this very issue. You can check that out in the archives. Dave, turning back to the EPA advisory guidelines, a keyword advisory, they're not binding on anybody, at least not yet. Is there a thought that they might be locked in and become an official federal regulation at some point in the future?
Well, it's a really interesting question, because these advisory limits, they mean almost nothing and they mean everything all at the same time. As you said, they are advisory. They're non-binding. You can't enforce anything based on where these standards sit right now. But they certainly do form the basis for what states are doing, as we've seen in Wisconsin with the NRB approving standards for drinking water at a level that matched the then existing federal advisory limit. And I think you're also going to see that number become the basis for the enforceable maximum contaminant levels under the Safe Drinking Water Act that EPA is in the process of putting in place right now. Now, that's a process that can take some time, but I think this is a very significant number overall, because it has the scientific backing to form the basis for what both the states and the federal government are likely to do. And to answer your other question, Rob, about when are federal standards coming, I think you're likely to see something in the next year or two. Now, that won't be immediately enforceable. There is a period of time that public water systems have to comply with EPA limits, but it's coming sooner rather than later, at least if we believe what the EPA is telling us.
Even with the DNR guidelines, which again are way less stringent than this advice from the EPA, what is it going to take for local communities, for local water systems to comply with it? Is it going to be a challenge?
It will be, especially for the smaller systems. If you're a small system already struggling with budget, I've been reading about how the prices of everything is going up from groceries to gasoline. Well, local governments are hit with that too. And if you are one of those smaller systems and, you know, you come back with a large number for PFAS in your system, I think the DNR's advice is to drill a new well. Well, that's expensive for one thing, and there's no guarantee that it's not pulling from the same source and won't be similarly contaminated for another. So, you know, again, it's a problem that everyone agrees something needs to be done, but when the rubber meets the road, it's not that easy to find a solution. You know, the bigger systems might be able to treat for it, install new treatment processes, but that's also an expensive proposition and one that might be out of reach for smaller systems. So in coming up with the rule, DNR did prepare cost estimates of, you know, how many systems it thought were likely to be affected and what the resulting cost might be. But we really have no idea how extensive the number is going to turn out in the end.
Now, this problem has been a long time in the making, and these chemicals don't really break down, not quickly, certainly by a human time span. Are we going to be dealing with stuff for, what, decades to come?
You know, it's like a lot of environmental problems, lead laterals, chlorides. This stuff, even if we turn off the faucet right now, the bathtub is still full. Carbon dioxide is another example of that. So, yeah, I think this is a problem that's going to be with us for a long time. We're finding out a lot more about these emerging contaminants, PFAS included, as we go. And we just have to do the best we can. But this is not something that is going to go away overnight.
And very briefly, what are you watching for next?
Well, I think the next big domino to fall will be enforceable standards, maximum contaminant levels under the Safe Drinking Water Act issued by the federal government. When that comes, all the states will have to fall into line.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's David Strifling, director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative. He was with us today looking at the impact of new PFAS standards set to go into place here in the state, regulating the so-called forever chemicals, plus new EPA guidelines. Earlier, we heard from WPR reporter Danielle Kading. You can follow her reporting on this issue at WPR.org. The congressional panel investigating the January 6th assault on the nation's capital is holding another hearing tomorrow. Live NPR coverage starts at noon here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Georgia's Secretary of State and other top election officials are expected to testify. President Biden won Georgia in the 2020 election. Former President Trump and his allies put pressure on those officials to try to undermine and overturn the results of the election. Join us for NPR special coverage of the January 6th hearings tomorrow at noon here on WPR. Longtime listeners to Central Time may know that I'm a big fan of the brown bears in Alaska's Katmai National Park. Now, I've never been there in person, but I've followed their annual fattest bear competition, and I watched the live bear cam showing the bears in streams and waterfalls. If you're also a fan, I've got good news. The Brooks Falls Bear Cam goes live tomorrow morning. I've been checking. The live cam doesn't run all year since the bears aren't there all year. But finally, after weeks of updating the site, the countdown timer is up. It's scheduled to go live tomorrow at 11 a.m. Central Time. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. I'll check in with you tomorrow on the show with a report if I don't get too distracted and just keep watching it and forget to do the show. It's bear news you can use. This is Central Time. And they just don't come no better than a bear. So meet a bear and take him on out to lunch with you. Even though your friends may stop instead.